Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's always better to hear it live, this is a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. Enjoy our latest installment. Shabbat Shalom. Of all of the interpretive riddles that have perplexed biblical commentators over the ages, none is more long-standing and insoluble than the matter of Pharaoh's hardened heart. The scene is one that we know well. If not from this week's Torah reading, then the Passover Seder, as Moses and Pharaoh lock horns over the fate of the enslaved Israelite nation. Plague after plague are sent by way of God's outstretched arm, each one intended to force Pharaoh's hand to set Israel free. Dramatic as a showdown may be, it's a story made complicated by way of God's ab initio declared intention to harden Pharaoh's heart. If, after all, the point of the plagues is to force Pharaoh's hand, then why, commentators over the ages have asked, would God incline Pharaoh to refuse to let Israel go? Why not just let the story of liberation play out without hardening his heart? It's a complication that only deepens with the arrival of the sixth plague of boils, as the text makes a subtle but significant change in the language from Pharaoh hardening his own heart to God hardening Pharaoh's heart. As a Spanish commentator, Ramban, succinctly asks, if God hardened Pharaoh's heart, then what was his crime? Philosophically speaking, we're left to square the circle of a God who would harden a person's disposition with Judaism's axiomatic belief in the principle of human free will. Throughout the ages, every Jewish biblical commentator has cut his or her teeth on this question. The 10th century Sadia Gaon downplays the problem with a suggestion that the language of hardening hearts is merely a statement of Pharaoh's resolve to defy God. Similarly, the 20th century Italian commentator Umberto Casuto relates that neither the expression itself nor the shift from the passive to the active is of philosophical significance. It's an expression meant to simply signal that Pharaoh dug in his proverbial heels. Chizkuni and Sforno skirt the issue by pointing out that Pharaoh's heart had to be hardened in order that he should suffer from all of the plagues, while the aforementioned Ramban relates that God declared that Pharaoh's heart had to be hardened so that Moses would not become disheartened when faced with Pharaoh's obduracy. My personal favorite, as related by Maimonides, the famed psychoanalyst Eric Fromm, and our bat mitzvah, Sophia, is that while Pharaoh may have initially hardened his heart by his own free will, the more he dug in, the less he could change. The language of God hardening Pharaoh's heart isn't meant to be taken literally, but figuratively. As we all know from our own lives and government shutdowns, the more we harden our positions, the more intractable we become, and the less likely that change will occur. Our predecessors have given us many options. And this morning, I want to build on these interpretive traditions, not so much by saying anything new, but by placing the question of Pharaoh's hardened heart in the context of the broader Exodus narrative, a story which began last week and will reach its denouement 2 weeks from now with Israelites' crossing of the sea. In other words, in order to untangle this particular riddle, I want to suggest that we have to look at the bigger picture, the broader arc of these chapters, and ask the question, what is this story really about? What is at the nub of the Exodus story? No question, it's a story about liberation, a people redeemed from slavery. No doubt it's a story about Moses and his development as a leader. No question it's a story about God remembering the covenant with Israel and Israel affirming their faith in God. The Exodus narrative is about all these things and more. But this morning, I want to suggest that at its core, the Exodus is a story about the liberation of the human condition, about the ability of human beings to exercise their God-given free will, and about how our ability or inability to actualize our will, and why it's that difference that makes us not just human, but human beings worthy of the label of being created in the image of God. Consider how our story begins. An Israelite nation subjugated by their Egyptian oppressors, the effects of hundreds of years of ruthless servitude weren't just physical, but also mental, of people unable to control their time, their choices, or their destiny, a nation deprived of their very humanity. And yet, before the very first chapter of Exodus is even complete, we're introduced to Shiphrah and Puah, who, from their modest position as Hebrew midwives, perform an extraordinary act of civil disobedience by ignoring Pharaoh's edict to kill the Israelite babies. On a narrative level, their non-compliance explains how Moses was able to survive. But on a more substantive level, their actions establish the fundamental tension of the chapter, if not the whole story. Like a Shakespearean drama, whereby the central tension is laid out in a small vignette in the opening act, so too here the author is saying, remember, even in the embittered darkness of slavery, even under the thumb of Pharaoh's power, the human will, the power to choose, exists and persists. Not even Pharaoh and all of his taskmasters could snuff out the light that make human beings human. It's a tension that takes on a new form in the next chapter with the introduction of Moses. Raised in a house of privilege, Moses goes out one day and encounters an Egyptian beating one of his Israelite kinsmen. Moses looks this way and that way, the text recounts, and he sees no man, and so he strikes the Egyptian down. Subsequent commentators explain that it wasn't the fact that Moses didn't see any man that prompted him to take action. After all, in the very next verse, it becomes clear that a whole lot of people saw exactly what he did. What Moses witnessed, with apologies for the gendered language, was that nobody was manning up. Perhaps out of fear of Pharaoh, perhaps because in Pharaoh's Egypt, evil had become normalized to the point that one could just shrug one's shoulders and turn away, every Israelite and every Egyptian had been rendered a bystander. The incident is significant because it's Moses' origin story, but its significance, like that of Shiphrah and Puah, like that of Moses driving off the offending shepherds in the scene to come, is that it highlights a core aspect of the human condition, namely that one always has a choice of how to behave, the ability to differentiate between right and wrong, and our willingness to make choices accordingly. That's what makes us human. And from that scene at the burning bush and into this week's Torah reading, it's this question which is a driver of the narrative. Despite the fact that Moses has distinguished himself as a man of action, he still resists the call to leadership. Not once, not twice, but no less than five times Moses balks, demurs, and refuses God's charge to lead. Who am I to lead them? Who shall I say sent me? I am slow of speech. What if they don't listen to me? The excuses are as numerous as they are varied, but they all point to the same question. Whether Moses will or won't step up for his brethren on a national scale as he did for his single Israelite brother. It is why God's response to Moses is so very important. Who gives man speech, God says? Who makes him dumb or deaf, seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? It's almost as if not exactly as if, God is telling Moses, don't tell me what human beings are or aren't capable of. I created you, I endowed you and all of humanity with those capabilities. The question isn't whether you are or are not capable of self-actualizing. You are. You are created in the divine image. The question is whether you will or will not step up to the moment. And it's this wrestling match that takes place within Moses, his soul, which is a challenge within the soul of the Israelite nation. Yes, Moses sought to free the Israelites from servitude, but it wasn't just a physical bondage from which they needed to be liberated. Moses' singular value added to the Israelite condition was that he convinced them that their present reality was a far cry from their God-given potential. It was Moses who instructed the Israelites, emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free your mind. The central drama of this week and next week's Parsha is not merely at what point will Pharaoh let Israel go. The central drama is a question of at what point will Israel believe in God and themselves to the point that they know that it's time to go, that they know that they were not put on this earth to serve Pharaoh, but to serve God, that they know that the mark of our humanity is our ability to exercise our free will, to make choices, and to live with the responsibility and the blessings that come with that capability. Which is where I believe the matter of God hardening Pharaoh's heart comes into play. Because unlike those interpreters who choose to soften the contradiction at hand by offering an elegant out, I am inclined to believe that God is doing exactly what God is saying God is doing. This showdown isn't just about the physical shackles of slavery. This showdown is between a Pharaoh who would deprive human beings of their right to exercise their free will and a God who has created humanity for the very purpose of exercising their free will. If I were to diagram this story out on a graph, it would have two lines, one for Pharaoh and one for Israel, curving in opposite directions. With every successive chapter, the Israelites increase in their ability to express their free will. With every successive chapter, Pharaoh's ability to exercise his free will is diminished. I believe God is making a very direct and very punitive judgment upon Pharaoh regarding his ability to do what he wants to do. You, Pharaoh, who would make yourself a god by making the Israelites less than human, I will show you who is God by making you less than human. The Nile, the locusts, the death of the Egyptian firstborn, God knew how to hit Pharaoh and hit him where it hurt. Hardening Pharaoh's heart was a coup de grace, the ultimate divine assertion by making Pharaoh unable to assert anything, until, of course, it was too late. You know, just a few days ago, together with many members of Park Avenue Synagogue, we visited Yad Vashem, Israel's Holocaust Memorial Museum. And the first thing you encounter before you even enter the museum itself is the Garden of the Righteous Among the Nations, trees planted for every non-Jew who helped save Jews during the horrors of the Shoah. I never fully understood why Yad Vashem would give such prominence to what was, relatively speaking, a de minimis number of lives saved by way of righteous Gentiles. Was it a shout out for the non-Jewish museum visitors, or maybe a way to provide a Hollywood silver lining to an otherwise horrific story? I don't know for sure, but this year it struck me that the Garden of the Righteous Gentiles, as you walk in, teaches the same message as the first chapters of Exodus, namely that one always has a choice. One walks through the Garden of Righteous on the way to the museum as a preemptive correction to the falsehood that perpetrators of the Shoah, or anyone for that matter, lack the ability to make moral distinctions and to make choices based on those distinctions. Like the famous picture of the single dock worker who refused to salute the Nazi regime in a sea of raised arms, like the midwives who performed acts of civil disobedience at their own peril, like Moses who finally found the wherewithal to act on behalf of his people. We always, even in the darkest hours, have the choice of how to behave. Friends, our lives, gratefully, are not playing out with the backdrop of Egyptian servitude, the Shoah, or other dark hours. For the most part, the choices we make are more modest, The stakes, thank God, not life or death. And yet, no different than any generation before, we all are faced with daily choices as individuals, as families, and as citizens. And like every generation that has come before, we don't lack for moral alibis, all the reasons why we cannot, should not, or will not do the right thing. Our hearts can be hardened no different than that of Pharaoh. Like Moses at the burning bush, we too must answer whether we are willing to differentiate right from wrong, call out injustice when we see it, muster the requisite courage to stand up for what is right, and demonstrate the resolve to see our choices through, even if, especially if, the going gets tough. As the rabbis taught so long ago, in a place where there are no men, strive to be a man. It is our ability to exercise our free will that's not just a measure of our humanity. It is the very thing that makes life worth living. Shabbat shalom. Thank you for listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. See you in shul. Hallelujah.